Hi and welcome to Undisclosed, the State versus Dennis Perry. This is episode 3, and this series is about how a double homicide in Camden County, Georgia turned into a cold case, and how 15 years later, Dennis Perry was convicted of the crime. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of A Non-Story, and I'm here with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
As a teenager, Dennis Perry moved around a lot. Mostly, he lived with his mother, but sometimes he lived with other relatives as well. Mostly, he was in Georgia, though in his ninth grade year, he was briefly enrolled in high school in South Carolina. After leaving South Carolina, he ended up with his grandparents in Camden County and attended high school there for a couple years before moving back to Atlanta with his mother. But then, when Dennis found out he was going to be held back at his new high school, instead of going in at the same grade he'd left at, he decided to drop out instead and started working. That's how he ended up meeting Clayton Tomlinson.
He got a job working at McDonald's doing maintenance. He was doing the maintenance after we shut down. Maintenance, cleaning, oil vats, and all that kind of stuff. And I was working at McDonald's. I mean, that was my first tax-paying job. That was it. We were connected.
Clayton and Dennis became fast friends, and through them, their families became close as well.
Anybody who knew me and Dennis, We were connected at the hip. My parents adopted him, his parents adopted me, and our moms knew everything about us.
A few years later on, Clayton had joined the Air Force and moved out to Texas, but he and Dennis remained close. And whenever Clayton was home on leave, hanging out with Dennis was on the agenda.
That was my big brother. Even though he's just a tad older than me, a year maybe, our relationship, I just know him. I know him. And it was walks and sneezes. We were just two peas in a pod. If you knew us and you saw one of us, the other one wasn't far. That's how everybody knew us.
I asked Clayton if he'd ever known Dennis to be violent or seen anything that maybe could explain why people would have decided that he was a likely murder suspect. And Clayton told me that he knows how when there's been some sort of horrific crime and then someone gets arrested for it, you always hear these stories after about how there'd been these warning signs all along, about how the person who'd been arrested had all these red flags that were overlooked at the time, but now, in hindsight, seemed to explain so much. And if that's what I was trying to find about Dennis Perry, well, Clayton said, I could give up the search right now.
Everybody looks back. They investigate back on those childhoods, and they always come up with these elaborate stories how people knew these individuals and how they were different. And There ain't no way anybody's going to find anybody that can say any of that kind of stuff about Dennis. It's just not going to happen.
Clayton was right. There is no one I've spoken to who has told me that they could recall Dennis Perry ever acting violently in any way, or threatening violence, or anything like that.
And I can't say anything bad about him. I mean, I can tell you stupid stuff that we did as stupid boys, but we never got in trouble. We never got in trouble with the law. We never got in trouble with the with the police. We never got in trouble with adults.
Clayton's mother, Donna Nash, told me that she couldn't even recall Dennis ever roughhousing like the rest of the boys. It just wasn't his nature.
Dennis was just quiet. He was like a, you know, like the other boys that graduated. They all went to the Marine Corps, the Air Force. Like my son went into the Air Force, Army. But Dennis didn't. He just was a, he's just a simple young man that, you know, he's got an education, bless his heart, for since he's been in this prison. Which I'm so proud of him for that. But I'm telling you, there is nobody in Clayton County or Riverdale that can say anything about that boy. And he lived in Locust Grove for a while, so you can go down there. He was never a problem. He never got in trouble.
In 1998, the police showed up at Donna Nash's doorstep one afternoon and asked to speak with her about Dennis Perry. They were trying to find information that could prove he didn't have an alibi for the day of the murders. But to Donna, the whole thing had just seemed completely absurd. Who cares where Dennis Perry was in some date 14 years ago?
They asked me a question. I would look at the guy and I said, "Do you guys ever met this young man? You meet him and you know his demeanor is nothing. He couldn't do this. It never happened. I promise you. I give you my word on it. Never. If I put my grandbaby's life on the line for it, all of them, he would never have done that."
According to Clayton, Dennis was a laid-back, fun-loving guy who'd do anything for you. That's how everyone who knew Dennis back in 1985 described him to me, more or less. Although not everyone would have used the exact same words that Clayton did. Dennis Perry was friendly and unable to harm a fly, they all told me. But where Clayton had described Dennis as easygoing, other people might have described him as a bit unmotivated or lacking direction. Other people, for instance, like Dennis's brother, Daniel Perry.
He always depended on us. We call him a bum, but you know, he just hung around Mama for a long, long, long time, in and out. And at that point, he had, I don't even know if there's medical records, but I know he fell out of a tree deer hunting, and he broke a bone in his back, and it was a few weeks before he could even move around, so he had to go stay with Mama, and that was before those murders happened.
That accident happened in December of 1984. Dennis was a month away from turning 23, and still in no particular hurry to completely fledge the nest. He'd worked various construction jobs and other odd jobs for a few years, and floated between Camden County and Atlanta and a few other places in Georgia. But he wasn't earning much and didn't have his own car, which didn't seem to bother Dennis much. He got along just fine without one. Though I get the sense that some of his family may have been less than thrilled with the situation.
He was there with us and didn't have any way of traveling. Anytime in his whole life he had had to go somewhere, he had to get somebody to take him.
Daniel and Dennis were only a couple of years apart in age, but to Daniel, the gap between him and his brother often felt much bigger than that. By 1985, Daniel was just finishing up his career in the military, had a wife and a couple of kids, while his brother Dennis, just a few years behind him, was still at home for the most part.
And he was always with Mom, like I said. When Mom was there, he was there. You know, until he was like 23 years old. We always made fun about that.
Whether Dennis Perry at 23 years old was a free spirit who was close with his family, or whether he was a slacker who was a bit of a mama's boy, is an open question, and the answer would probably depend upon your point of view, and probably neither answer is more accurate than the other.
The hiring process is no walk in the park. It takes a lot of time, energy, and effort to go through and find qualified candidates, go through stacks of resumes, check references. But there's one place where you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. A place where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates easily. And that place is ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. ZipRecruiter sends your job over to 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. They've got powerful matching technology, they scan thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience, and they invite them to apply to your job. And when the applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates, so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. With results like that, it's no wonder that ZipRecruiter is the highest rating hiring site in America. And right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. Once again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. In 1983, Dennis's mother, Helen, had another baby. Shane, Dennis's little brother, was 21 years his junior. Around that time, Dennis had moved out again from his mother's place and ended up back in Camden County again with his grandparents, Zeke and Susie Wilson, in their little house over on Dover Bluff Road in the tiny community of Waverly. There wasn't much of a plan to it. Dennis worked the odd construction job here and there and helped his grandmother out with tasks because his grandfather had some trouble getting around. He had suffered an injury years earlier during a family gathering out at a lake north of Camden County. Zeke Wilson and Dennis had been out on a boat ride along with a few other family members when it happened. Here's Dennis's uncle, Ed Wilson, describing the incident.
I was in Europe in the Army, and he and the family were having a Mother's Day thing in outside of Savannah. And some guy just went crazy and shot him and my sister. She got shot in the leg. And he got shot four or five times.
Some kind of boating rage accident?
Yeah. You know, just all of a sudden, the guy just lost it.
Ed's sister wasn't as seriously injured, but Ed's father, Dennis's grandfather, was partially paralyzed. So sometimes Dennis had ended up staying with his grandparents to help out his grandmother as needed.
Like I said, he stayed with my mom and dad for a while when he was young, and dad was still having trouble getting around because of being shot.
When Dennis moved in with his grandparents in 1983, it wasn't his first time living in Camden County. Back in the late 70s, Dennis Perry had ended up there before, and he attended high school there for a couple of years. But that happened a few years ago, and other than his grandparents and his great-uncle's family, who lived just a few doors down from them, Dennis didn't really know too many people in the area. He did have one family friend who lived nearby, though, a guy named Keith Warren. Keith had actually been friends with Dennis's brother Daniel, but when Dennis moved back to Camden County, he and Keith became fast friends. And it was through Keith Warren that Dennis Perry would end up meeting a girl down in Camden County. Her name was Carol Ann, but most people called her Buzz, a nickname she still goes by today. Buzz was a few years older than Dennis and had a young son from a previous relationship. She worked at a convenience store over on Blith Island, just across the river in Glynn County, and most evenings after she got off of work, she and Dennis would hang out together. Buzz lived right around the corner from Dennis's grandparents, and Dennis could walk to her place in just a couple of minutes. And since Dennis didn't have a car, that worked out pretty well. Besides, once he and Buzz started dating, Dennis hadn't really needed a car of his own. Buzz could drive him wherever he needed to go. Buzz and Dennis would end up dating for the 2 years Dennis was in Camden County, from 1983 to 1985. In an alternate universe, where Dennis Perry had stayed in Camden County, they might have ended up married. That's how some of the people around them expected things to end up anyway. But then, the hunting accident happened, and Dennis couldn't stay in Camden County, and Dennis and Buzz's lives went in different directions. But although Dennis had no way of knowing it at the time, his relationship with Buzz would eventually change the trajectory of his entire life. It would just take 15 years before Dennis would find out how.
On December 5th, 1984, while staying with his grandparents down in Camden County, Dennis had gone out deer hunting and had misjudged a tree limb that he'd been using as a deer stand. That limb came crashing down with Dennis on it, and it was a 20-foot fall at least, if not more. At first, Dennis had tried to walk it off, but the next day, when it became clear this was not the sort of thing that could simply be walked off, he'd gone to Carol Ann to drive him to the hospital in Brunswick. There, it was determined he'd fractured a vertebrae, and he was admitted to the hospital for a few days and was told that once he was released, he'd not be in a position to care for himself for a bit. Dennis's mother, Helen, drove down to Brunswick to pick him up and then drove him back to her place in Jonesboro to recuperate.
Well, Dennis, when he broke his back, he fell off a house and broke his back. And he was in a body brace, and he came back up here to be with his mother. And he lived with her in the trailer at that trailer park. It was hard for me to find it the first time I went over there. Well, then he got a job right across the street from the cemetery, and it used to be, there's a little plaza there, and he worked at the gas station there.
Dennis had been supposed to wear the body brace for at least 3 months, but he'd quickly grown restless. A few weeks in, he decided to ditch the brace early on and go back to work. He got a job at the gas station across the street because it was the only job he could get to on foot, and he didn't have any other way of getting around. He didn't stay at the gas station long, though. When he was feeling a bit stronger, he got a job at a concrete place, the one that 15 years later would be his alibi for a double homicide. They wouldn't have any records to prove it. Dennis's neighbor Charlie worked at a concrete plant too, which is the only reason that Dennis was able to get work there. Charlie could give Dennis a ride to and from work. And so, he started a new chapter of his life in Atlanta. But there was only one complication. His girlfriend Buzz was still in Camden County. After Dennis's mom drove him back to Jonesboro to recuperate from the accident, he and Buzzard decided they'd try to give the long-distance thing a shot, and they'd remain boyfriend and girlfriend throughout the first few months of at least 1985. They talked on the phone, and they'd seen each other when they could. On at least two occasions, Buzz had come from Camden County to Atlanta to visit him, and Dennis had looked for ways to visit her, though visits going in the other direction were harder, owing to Dennis's lack of a car.
One solution to Dennis's lack of a car would have been for him just to rent one out. And Dennis had actually tried that once, a few months before he'd broken his back by falling out of a tree, during a short spell when he'd been up in Jonesboro, living there with his mother. He'd wanted to get back to Camden County to see Buzz, so he'd asked his mom to rent a car in her name, since he didn't have a stable enough credit history to rent one out himself, and she'd agreed and rented the car, and Dennis had paid for it in cash at the counter. And off he went to Camden County. But just an hour out from Waverly, he'd rear-ended another car at a stoplight and totaled the rental car. His mom had had to drive down from Jonesboro to pick him up, and since the place where Dennis had wrecked had been almost in Waverly already, Dennis's mother had decided just to drive the rest of the way to his grandparents' house so they could stay there for the night, before leaving the next morning back for Jonesboro, without the wrecked rental car. So, for Dennis and Buzz, the long distance had been problematic. They had no regular way of seeing each other, with no sign that they'd be able to fix that anytime soon. And so, at some point in 1985, they'd finally given in to the inevitable and gone their separate ways. It was an amicable split, with no hard feelings on either side. Dennis remained on friendly terms with Buzz and her family. And then, in 1988, Buzz's mother, Jane Beaver, moved into a trailer just down the road from Dennis's grandparents. And for a few years after that, whenever Dennis was back in Camden County for a family event, he'd stop by Buzz's mother's house to check on her, just to say hi and see how she was doing. Though Dennis had admitted to me with a kind of embarrassed laugh, these friendly visits might have been motivated less out of a concern for Jane Beaver's welfare, and more out of a hope he might run into Buzz there, and see if maybe they could strike things up again. They never did, though, and eventually, after Dennis moved to Jacksonville and met his wife Karen, the friendly visits to Jane Beaver became more and more infrequent, and at the time of his arrest in 2000, he hadn't seen her in years.
On November 2nd, 1988, the Unsolved Mysteries episode on the Swain case aired for the first time at 8 p.m. that evening. 52 minutes after the episode ended, a man named Corky Rozier called up the Unsolved Mysteries tip line, and whoever took the call recorded these notes from his call.
Dennis Perry fits the composite drawing. Harold Swain owned land. Dennis Perry dealt drugs to Harold's nephews. Harold found out about these dealings. Dennis lives about a mile from the church, visiting with his grandparents. He drove a beige Plymouth Duster. He has given this info to Butch Kennedy, the investigator. He does have a photograph of this guy.
In the standard retelling of this investigation, this is how Dennis Perry's name first appeared in the Swain investigation. Through this tip, called in to Unsolved Mysteries. But that's not completely true. That's actually the second time there's a record of Dennis Perry's name being submitted.
This is far as I can be, the very first reference to Dennis Perry that ever appears in the case file. The first time that Dennis Perry's name is ever associated with the murder of Harold and Thelma Swain.
On August 1st, 1988, a few months before the Unsolved Mysteries tip was called in, Deputy Butch Kennedy received a tip in the Swain case. There's a case report on it, a one-page summary filled out on a sheet titled Investigator's Case Activity Summary. Susan showed Butch Kennedy the report to see what he might be able to tell her about it.
And it says, who is B.J. Smiley?
B.J. was a police officer or an investigator in Kingsland at one time, and then he later moved to the sheriff's office.
So he obtained information from a confidential source, and then, but confidential to me means like confidential, you're not going to tell the outside world. What it mean confidential is, and he can't tell the lead investigator who the source is? Is that common?
Usually not.
So his source, who wants to be confidential, says that Zeke Wilson's grandson, Dennis Perry, was visiting at the time of the homicide and left the next day and has not returned. His source was familiar with the Wilsons and knew Perry, and his physical makeup was similar to the composite. Further, an overheard conversation by a third party, by Harold Swain and a grandson, Williams, indicated that the grandson was growing marijuana on some of Harold's land, and Harold wanted the marijuana destroyed, or he was going to notify the authorities. Detective Smiley's source stated the next day Mr. Swain was killed.
Although the tip was initially anonymous, it doesn't seem to have taken Butch Kennedy long to figure out who it came from. The tipster was again actually Corky Rozier, the same man who called into Unsolved Mysteries about Dennis Perry a few months later in November. Corky Rozier passed away a few years ago, but Susan spoke to his wife Glenda and his youngest daughter Lori. Lori had been pretty young at the time that all this was going on, and she wasn't aware of what actually had gone on with the tip that Corky Rozier had phoned in, but she did remember that it had actually been her sister, Vicky, who first brought up Dennis Perry's name.
We were all sitting around watching the news, mm-hmm. and my oldest sister, Vicky, which is the investigator, she was watching TV, and they showed a picture, a drawing, and she said, "Daddy, that looks like Dennis." And he said, "Dennis who?" And she said, "Dennis Perry, the guy I went to school with." That's how that whole thing got started.
Corky Rozier hadn't just given the police the tip about Dennis Perry, he'd also given them a photo of Dennis as well. Actually, it was Dennis Perry's high school ID from his freshman year at West Hardeeville High School in South Carolina.
So that was all he had said was, "Hey, my daughter said that looked like Dennis." So she had a picture of him, and she took the picture and handed it to Daddy, and he showed the investigator.
What picture was it, do you know?
Some high school picture.
Lori couldn't remember anything about her father calling in a tip to a TV show, but Glenda remembered that at some point, Corky had also made some kind of call to Unsolved Mysteries.
Because he did call Unsolved Mysteries, but I just can't think of which one it was, what it was, that we kind of figured it out.
I don't know about that.
Was it just this case?
I'm not sure if it's that
case. Oh, it's this case. His name's on it, so it had to be him.
He did call Unsolved Mysteries, yeah. Mm-hmm. I know he did it one time because he was so mad because we couldn't get, find out who did it. Mm-hmm. Because, he was trying to find out who did it. He cared about Mr. and Ms. Swain. Mm-hmm. He knew him all of his life. But that's probably why, because he was trying to figure out who did it, because he wanted to get even with the person that did that. Mm-hmm. Because that's a terrible, terrible way to go.
In the files from the original investigation into the Swain case, the one done by Butch Kennedy back in the 1980s, there are 7 pages in all about Dennis Perry, and those pages seem to have been made in the course of investigating this tip from Corky Rozier. There's a Xerox copy of Dennis's high school ID, 4 pages of case activity summaries, 2 pages of, quote, "while you were out" notes, with updates on calls that had come in for Butch Kennedy while he was out of the office, and 1 page of notes from a spiral-bound notebook with a short section on Dennis Perry. Except for the whole "while you were out" memos, the handwriting on all of this is Butch Kennedy's. So Susan asked him what he could remember about his investigation into Dennis Perry.
I honestly don't remember. Mm-hmm. I don't remember this. I know that it's mine.
But would it be common for you to get a tip from someone and you start checking it out like this? Mm-hmm. Okay, so what you're seeing here doesn't surprise you as something you would do, you just don't recall doing it.
I don't recall doing it.
But even though Butch Kennedy has no independent memory today of that part of his investigation, by piecing together these call records and notes, we can see the steps he took back in 1988 to follow up on Corky Rozier's tip. First, there's the initial activity summary. Butch Kennedy fills that out on August 1st. And then, 4 days later, on August 5th, he adds another update in the activity report. A detective with the Hardeeville, South Carolina police has been contacted, and he's attempting to locate more information on Dennis Perry. Kennedy also sends a copy of the composite image of the suspect to South Carolina. Then, on August 8th, Butch Kennedy and the South Carolina police officer begin a brief game of phone tag, until finally, on the morning of August 12th, they connect. The South Carolina officer tells Butch Kennedy that Dennis Perry had left the South Carolina school, and his last known address was in College Park, Georgia. A little later that same morning, at 10:30 a.m., there's another activity entry in Butch Kennedy's log. Quote, "criminal history check attached, driver's license and history attached." Though if Kennedy ever did add those attachments to the file, they're not there now. Through these pages of notes, you can watch as Butch Kennedy follows Dennis Perry's life, beginning with his freshman year in West Hardeeville, following him from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, from one last known address to the next, asking each agency along the way for more information on Dennis Perry.
So So it looks like to me is that right after you get this tip from this confidential source, you start looking into Dennis Perry. You contact a place where you thought he lived. He'd moved away long ago, but you go and try and get a photo of him, which
I honestly don't remember.
There's a record of the incident report from Wayne County from the time Dennis had crashed the rental car when he'd driven down to see his girlfriend, and a record of a traffic violation he'd gotten while living in Locust Grove, as well as correspondence between Butch Kennedy and Georgia Power in an attempt to track down Dennis or his mother through utility bills, and notes throughout about requests to various jurisdictions to see if any had a photo of Dennis Perry. Finally, on October 7th, 1988, there's one final update on Butch Kennedy's case activity summaries. It says, quote, Locust Grove Police Officer Patton has somewhat located someone who worked with Perry and is making an effort to locate him at this time. And that's it. Following that October 1988 entry, the investigative file goes silent on Dennis Perry. There's the Unsolved Mysteries tip in November, tucked into thousands of other pages of similar tips, and then nothing until 1993, when a deputy named Chuck Byerly went through all of Butch Kennedy's files after he was fired. Deputy Byerly organized Kennedy's records into a set of 9 binders, arranged by topic, and prepared a list of suspects in the case and assigned them numbers. And there, Dennis Perry's name appears again, designated as S-0037. And then nothing again until 1998, when Dale Bundy takes over, and then suddenly Dennis Perry's name is everywhere, on almost every sheet of paper.
But when I first saw Butch Kennedy's notes on Dennis Perry, what stood out to me was the form he'd used for 4 of those pages. The pre-prepared sheets titled Investigator's Case Activity Summary. Later, I'd obtain more case records, and in those thousands of pages, I'd find 2 more like this, both of those from August 7, 1990, and they're not about Dennis Perry, but about a different suspect in the case. But still, that makes only 6 of them in all. These forms had never been used for any other part of the investigation. Why, over the course of a 5-year investigation, had Butch Kennedy decided to use these case activity summaries for those 6 pages, but never any other time?
So, but you would be very surprised, you said, if these were the only notes you'd taken in this case on these forms.
Yes.
Butch Kennedy used those forms, those investigators' case activity summary sheets, a lot. Or at least that's how he remembers it now. But there are no other forms in any of the tens of thousands of pages we've gone through that use this type of sheet. So if there were more case activity summaries from Butch Kennedy's investigation, they're gone now. As are the rest of the while you were out call memos. Unless August of 1988 is the only time that Butch Kennedy regularly missed calls. So maybe what we have isn't the whole file. And maybe there was more investigation done into Dennis Perry than the record we have now shows. From the records that we do have of Butch Kennedy's investigation, it's clear that there's nothing in there that shows Dennis Perry ever being ruled out as a possible suspect. There had been an attempt by Deputy Kennedy to find Dennis Perry after the tip from Corky Rozier had come in, and it seems like Kennedy had at least gotten close to finding someone who had worked with Dennis. But that's the end of it. It's as if the whole lead had just been forgotten, and no one ever remembered to follow up on it. Though, of all the suspects in the Swain case file, Dennis Perry is not alone in that regard. Out of the 100-plus suspects that are named there on the various pages, there are only records that rule out maybe a dozen of them, a couple dozen at most. Most of the leads are just kind of left there hanging. But it is true that there's nothing in the file to document conclusively that Dennis Perry had been eliminated as a suspect. Which is apparently why, when Dale Bundy took over the case in 1998, he considered Dennis Perry to be a viable suspect. But as small as Butch Kennedy's file is on Dennis Perry, if you're going by page count, then Dale Bundy's file on Dennis Perry is actually even smaller. It's only 6 pages long, compared to the 7 pages that Butch Kennedy has. But that's not because pages from Dale Bundy's file might have gone missing. Bundy just never made the file to begin with.
I worked this case for a while on my own. And then I was assigned assistance from the GBI by a fellow named Ron Rhodes, who now works for the DEA. And Ron was the note taker and the recorder, et cetera, because the GBI had the ability to have his notes transcribed and dictated and things like that. Plus, you get two reports going in an investigation, you know as well as I do, that's not a good idea. So, you know, we worked as a team on this case after a certain point.
By his own admission, Dale Bundy is not really much of a note taker. And as a result, there are no contemporaneous records of the first 5 months of Dale Bundy's investigation into the Swain case. Instead of making records while the investigation was ongoing, Bundy waited until November of 1998, and then he wrote up a 6-page summary of all the work he had done on the case from July to November. Luckily, at the end of 1998, the GBI was brought in to assist Bundy, so we do have some records about what was happening during the reopened investigation into the Swain case. The GBI made and kept regular records of the work they did, and to date, the GBI has only lost some of those records. So, starting in November of 1998, there's at least a semi-regular documentation of what the GBI was doing on this case. But as for what happened during those first few months of the investigation, when Dale Bundy came on and developed Dennis Perry as a suspect, well, that 6-page Bundy report is all we have to go on.
The Bundy report begins on July 1st, 1998. On that day, Dale Bundy was assigned primary responsibility on the Swain case, and from July 1st to July 7th, he reviewed the GBI and Sheriff's Office reports on the case from the past 13 years. Through the course of that review, Bundy realized that the eyewitnesses in the case had not been re-interviewed since the murders took place, 13 years previously. He decided that that would be the best place to begin his investigation.
The witnesses were old black people that lived in Waverly, Georgia. And I have learned something as a police officer, that people like that grew up in a time when it was even harder to be black than it is now. Much harder. They don't tell people things unless they're asked, and they have to trust you to talk to you. I drove my own vehicle up there. I would go and sit on the porch with these people with shorts, tennis shoes, and a t-shirt on, because they didn't want anybody to know the police were visiting and talking to them about things, because they knew that the man that killed the Swains came and went from Camden County regularly. They knew who he was. They told me who he was. And they were afraid that if they said anything, the same thing would happen to them. His grandfather lived right up on Dover Bluff Road.
By interviewing the original witnesses in the case, Dale Bundy very quickly began to make progress in his case.
When you say told you he was, you mean they told you about, like, did they give you a name or did they give you a description?
Here's how this went. There was one lady that was, in my opinion, was key to this. She's dead now. Her name is Cora Fisher.
Cora Fisher was the very first witness Dale Bundy spoke to in his investigation. On July 8th, 1 week after being assigned to the case, he went to her house to conduct an interview.
Miss Cora was sitting by the organ when the shootings happened. When Thelma Swain ran to the back of the church, they're killing Harold. She flies through these little doors into the narthex. Cora Fisher saw Thelma get murdered, and she passed out. She fainted. But she had a very vivid memory of what she saw. And when I went and sat down with Cora and talked to her about it, I had to play 20 questions with her. Things like, I could tell by the way she was talking to me, she had something else she wanted to say. And I asked her, I said, Cora, do you think you know who killed Harold and Thelma Swain? She said, I don't think anything. I know who killed Harold and Thelma Swain. Well, the world stopped.
At that point, Dale Bundy knew he was on the verge of solving the case. There was just one problem, convincing Cora Fisher it was safe to tell him what she knew.
I said, who? She said, I'm not going to tell you a name because I don't want the same thing to happen to me.
But Cora Fisher did agree to share one clue about the man's identity. At some point in the early to mid-1990s, this man had started parking in front of her house and watching her. Here's Dale Bundy recounting what Cora Fisher had told him during that first interview and his questions to her about it.
He started coming down here and would sit in front of my house in his grandfather's car and stare at me. And I said, okay. And I had found out a little bit about Dennis, just reading up on things. And I said, does his grandfather live up on Dover Bluff Road? She says, yes. She said, but I'm not going to tell you any names. I said, okay. Well, I knew right then who she was talking about.
Cora Fisher might have been too scared to give Dale Bundy any names, but Dale Bundy didn't need any names to know who she was talking about, Dennis Perry.
The next entry in the Bundy report is from 2 days later. The report reads,
on July 9th, 1998, I sent a fax to the records department in Jacksonville, Florida Sheriff's Department, requesting a picture of Perry. He'd been arrested there in 1991.
On July 13th, Jacksonville sent Bundy back a mugshot of Dennis Perry from a misdemeanor breach of peace arrest in 1990. Dale Bundy called Cora Fisher, hoping to set up an interview, but when she answered the phone, Bundy could tell immediately from Cora's voice that something was wrong. She had fallen down the steps, she told him, and had been injured. Dale Bundy called an ambulance to her house and then headed over there himself. He arrived before the ambulance did and found Ms. Cora Fisher sitting on the ground in her carport. She was calmer now, and she told Bundy that she'd hurt her knee in the fall, but otherwise, Bundy says, she seemed all right. In his report, Bundy wrote,
I asked her if she would look at the photograph of Perry that I had received. Ms. Fisher agreed to look at the photograph and appeared to be upset when she looked at the picture. She glanced at the picture and quickly turned her head away.
Not long after that, the ambulance arrived and took Cora Fisher to the hospital. But before it got there, Bundy had time to ask Cora one question.
I says, is the man in that picture the man that killed Harold and Thelma Swain? And she says, unless he has a twin brother.
Based on Cora Fisher's identification, Dennis Perry became suspect number one in the Swain case.
There were nearly a dozen witnesses who were at the missionary meeting at Rising Daughter on the night that Harold and Thelma Swain were killed, but not all of them had actually seen the young white man in the vestibule. And some of the women who had seen him had only got the briefest of glimpses, and they were unable to help with any sort of identification. Louise Baker, for instance, never saw the man at all, and Maddie Owens had gotten a glimpse, but she told the police in the days after the murder that, quote, she didn't pay any attention to the man. People were always coming into the church wanting money, help, and things like that. So she couldn't provide any information about him. And Margie Moore, the woman who'd gotten the broom and run to Reed's store for help, had gotten a look at the killer, but she passed away before Bundy got on the case. But of all the witnesses, only one of them saw the young white man in the vestibule at close range, and that was Vinzolda Williams. The other women had, at best, only caught a glimpse of the man, a brief look as he peeked into the main sanctuary while standing out in the vestibule. But Vinzolda had actually spoken to the man when he asked to speak to Harold Swain. She was in a hurry to pick up her daughter and didn't pay too much attention to him at the time, but for 3 or 4 seconds at least, she actually looked at him and talked to him. And Vinzolda Williams is the second and last witness from the church that Dale Bundy interviewed and showed a photo to of Dennis Perry.
Vinzolda and Cora, because those were the two that actually saw what they saw. I mean, Vinzolda walked out and spoke to Dennis. And, you know, Cora saw him shoot Thelma. So, yeah, I showed them the picture.
There were other women from the church who had gotten glimpses of the shooter and who were still alive at the time of Dennis Perry's arrest, but for various reasons, none of the other women were ever asked to identify Dennis, either from a photo or a lineup.
And there's two more that actually saw him, sort of. Gwen Owens is one of them.
Gwen Owens isn't going to say anything to anybody. Her
really?
Husband told her to stay out of this. Her husband told her to tell the people that the man had red hair and flame shooting out of his eyes or something similar. She had her daughter there in the church with her, too, that night, and told her daughter not to say anything. So I wrote Gwen Owens off real quick. I mean, she was a non-cooperative witness. Again, she was one of these people that was afraid to say anything because of Dennis's ties locally. That was my opinion.
So that just left Cora Fisher and Vinzolda Williams as the only witnesses to identify photos of Dennis Perry as a man from the vestibule. At trial, the prosecutor had asked and had been granted permission to have Vinzolda Williams make an in-court identification of Dennis Perry. But in the end, for whatever reason, the prosecutor opted to only have her identify a photo of Dennis instead. and Cora Fisher had been too ill to attend trial, so she testified via deposition from her nursing home, which means she was never in a position to make an in-court identification of Dennis Perry at all. Still, Cora Fisher was adamant that the photo of Dennis Perry she had been shown was a man that she'd seen that night at Rising Daughter. In her testimony, when she was asked if the man in the photo was a man who killed Harold and Thelma Swain, she said there was no question in her mind about it. "Ain't no doubt," she said, "that's the same boy." But Venzola Williams' identification had always been less absolute than Cora's identification. At a pretrial hearing, Venzola Williams testified that when a photo of Dennis Perry had been shown to her, she thought that he did look like the man from the church that night, but she couldn't be sure and still wasn't sure. Cora Fisher, she told the court, had recognized the photo, but as for herself, quote, "he looked like the man that night, but I can't say for sure that he was the man."
Within 2 weeks of beginning his investigation into the Swain case, Dale Bundy already had two women who had identified a photo of Dennis Perry as the shooter, and he was confident in the reliability of both their identifications. But while Dale Bundy now believed he had identified who had killed Harold and Thelma Swain, did nothing to answer the question of why they had been killed. Sure, the initial tips from Corey Rozier back in 1988 had said this all had something to do with marijuana growing somewhere or something like that, but no evidence of anything like that had ever been found to substantiate the claim. So, why had Dennis Perry done this? Dale Bundy didn't have an answer to that question at first. But then he went looking for a woman named Jane Beaver.
So for two evenings, I got out. Finally, I went to Jane Beaver's door. Knocked on the door. Jane Beaver came to the door. I showed her my badge, told her why I was there. She says, "It's about damn time. Come on in and I'll tell you what you need to make your case." That's how I got on to Jane Beaver.
Jane Beaver's the mother of Carol Ann, a.k.a. Buzz, Dennis Perry's ex-girlfriend from Camden County. Jane Beaver hadn't actually lived in Camden County when Dennis Perry lived there, but in 1988, she moved into a trailer near her father, just around the corner from where Dennis's grandparents lived on Dover Bluff. And that's where Dale Bundy had found her on July 23rd, 1998.
Jane Beaver told us, when I say us, I'm talking about Ron Rhodes and I, that Dennis had said he tried to borrow money from Harold Swain at one time. And Harold laughed at him and wouldn't loan him any money. And he told that to Jane Beaver. And he says, "I'm going to kill that N-word."
At trial, Jane Beaver gave a similar but slightly more expansive answer to the question of what Dennis Perry had told her about his plans to kill Harold Swain, one that put a greater emphasis on a possible racial motivation for the murders. Beaver testified that a few weeks before Harold and Thelma Swain had been shot at Rising Donner, Dennis Perry had come to her house and told her, quote, "I always wondered what it was like to kill an N-word, and now I'm going to get me one." If Jane Beaver's story is believed, there seems to be little doubt that Dennis Perry killed the Swains. And Dale Bundy found no reason to doubt Jane Beaver's story. Yes, she was the mother of Dennis's ex-girlfriend, but that didn't play any role in Jane Beaver's motivations for coming forward. And Bundy's right. There is nothing at all to indicate that Jane Beaver, her daughter Buzz, had any access to grind with Dennis.
Jane had no reason to accuse Dennis of this if she didn't know something. Her daughter had dated Dennis for a while.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. There's like animosity because of that. It doesn't seem like it was really big deal.
No.
Over the next year and a half of the investigation into the Swain murders, there were other bits and pieces of things that Dale Bundy would pick up over the course of his investigation that he thought pointed toward Dennis Perry's guilt. Some of that was even used at trial, but none of that evidence was as significant as the evidence that Bundy had obtained in the first three interviews he had conducted in the case. The time of Dennis Perry's arrest in January 2000, the case against him was largely based on those interviews from July of 1998, the identification of Dennis by Venzola Williams and Cora Fisher, and Jane Beaver's statement about what Dennis Perry had told her not long before the murders. But some of you may have questions, at least, about the eyewitness evidence in this case and about why Cora Fisher and Venzola Williams had been shown a single photo of Dennis Perry and asked to identify whether he was the killer based on that one photo. That's a question that Dale Bundy has been asked before.
There were people that said, "Why didn't you do a photo lineup?" You know, they did one. It's very simple. The witnesses had already seen the picture of Dennis. I mean, what the heck good would it have done to do a photo lineup?
Yeah.
at that point.
That was all done before I ever got my hands on the case.
By the time Del Bundy had gotten to and interviewed Cora Fisher and Vanzola Williams, they had already been shown a photo of Dennis Perry and had already been asked if he was the man who had killed the Swains. In fact, that was the reason Cora Fisher had been so confident that she'd known who the killer was when Bundy first spoke to her. Cora Fisher told Bundy that a few years before, a woman had come to her and shown her a single picture of a young white man with shoulder-length hair and asked her if he was the man who had killed Harold and Thelma Swain. And when Cora Fisher had seen that photo, she'd been so upset by seeing the face of the killer once again that she had fainted. And in the very first interview with Del Bundy, Cora Fisher had told him where he could find the woman who had come to her house with a picture of Dennis Perry.
And I asked her who the lady was with the picture. Again, I'm not going to tell you any names. Where does she live? She lives between Reed's store and the county line in a house trailer. What's she look like? She's got blonde hair and wears thick glasses.
So that's why, in July of 1998, Dale Bundy had been going up and down US 17 between the Reed's store and the county line, knocking on doors and asking if anyone there had any information on a man named Dennis Perry.
There, she says, it's about damn time. Come on in and I'll tell you what you need to make your case. That's how I got on to Jane Beaver. Jane Beaver told me about going to see Cora Fisher, and she named Dennis Perry. She gave me the picture that she had used the whole lot of wax.
Is this the one with the kid? The one with the baby?
Or the, yeah, the photograph of him holding
a small child.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, the woman who'd gone around showing the church witnesses a photo of Dennis Perry was Jane Beaver, the mother of Dennis Perry's ex-girlfriend, and the same witness who had told Dale Bundy that Dennis had told her in advance of his plans to kill Harold Swain. The picture had actually come from Dennis's ex-girlfriend, Buzz. They had broken up in 1985, but Buzz had kept a couple photos of Dennis, including one snapshot in particular that she'd cut down to fit inside of a wooden oval picture frame. The photo was from Easter of 1984, and it shows Dennis Perry lying on a living room floor, helping Shane, his baby brother, stand up. Shane's about 8 months old in the photo, all giant toothless smile and chubby arm rolls, and Dennis is laying on the floor, propping Shane up on the pillow. And he's staring into the camera with a sort of quiet half-grin, his shaggy hair tucked behind his ears. It's a good photo of him, and you can kind of see why maybe it's a photo of him that he'd wanted his girlfriend to have. Though, if that photo had never been taken, it's very likely that Dennis Perry would not currently be serving two life sentences. Jane Beaver had thought that photo of Dennis had looked a lot like the composite drawing prepared by four of the eyewitnesses. So, back in 1992, give or take a year, she had decided to take this photo and go show it to the church ladies. She'd found Cora Fisher first, and gone to Cora's home and shown her the photo. And then, a bit later on, she met with Cora Fisher again, who this time had brought Vanzola Williams along with her. And Jane Beaver had shown the photo to them both.
Did you ever talk to her, to Vanzola?
Oh, yeah.
Did she ever identify Dennis?
She did.
Okay.
I asked her about the picture that Miss Beaver had brought around. When she went to Cora Fisher's house, Cora got on the phone and called Vanzola and said, I need you to come over here. She went to Cora Fisher's house and saw the picture.
So long before Dale Bundy had ever showed up on either of their doorsteps, Cora Fisher and Vanzola Williams had already known what Dennis Perry looked like. And Jane Beaver had shown Bundy his photo and told him she thought he'd killed the Swains. And when Dale Bundy had shown Cora Fisher and Vanzola Williams the single mugshot photo of Dennis Perry, Cora and Vanzola had already known the man in the mugshot was the same as the man from the photo that Jane Beaver had shown them a photo of years before. Dale Bundy acknowledges that this is not, to say the least, the standard way the eyewitnesses are asked to make photo identifications. But the circumstances here were completely beyond his control. Jane Beaver, a private party, had taken on her own initiative to show Cora Fisher and Vanzola Williams the photos of Dennis Perry, and Dale Bundy had no possible way of unringing that bell. And besides, Bundy says, this was not the kind of case where you needed a lineup to make an accurate identification. In some situations, sure, that's the better way of doing it. But here, that wouldn't have mattered.
I mean, I understand where you're coming from. Ideally, if they have no idea who did it, but these people knew. These people knew. They had seen this guy. This was not a random person, okay? This is a lady saying, is this the person that killed Harold and Thelma Swain? And them knowing who he is.
According to Dale Bundy, court officials' identification of Dennis Perry would have happened the same regardless of the type of lineup she was shown. To Bundy, Cora's description of how she'd reacted to seeing Dennis Perry's photograph was confirmation that her identification was accurate. Didn't matter if she was shown one photo or six or 12, she'd have known who Dennis Perry was regardless.
Did it ever, were you ever concerned that maybe Cora Fisher was, because she'd been shown this photo several times by Jane Beaver, that that affected her memory and that that influenced?
No, ma'am.
But is it impossible that could have happened? Like, with someone?
No, ma'am.
Not in Cora's case, but in general. Would you not think that that could be a factor that if someone's repeatedly shown a photo, that it could affect it, right?
Repeatedly shown a photo?
Of someone, says the suspect.
Cora Fisher looked at that photo one time and fell out on the floor.
What do you mean when you say that? Like literally fell?
She passed out again just like she did in the church.
Like literally went down to the ground.
That's right.
That was the time that Mrs. Beaver showed it.
When Ms. Beaver showed her that picture.
You weren't present for that.
I was not.
But Vanzola Williams had never shared Cora Fisher's certainty about the identification of Dennis Perry. And Cora Fisher's identification, standing alone, would not have been as strong on its own if it had been contradicted by Vanzola Williams, who unquestionably had a better opportunity to see and speak to the killer. While Vanzola Williams had, in her pretrial testimony, repeatedly hedged her answers, downplaying her identification of Dennis Perry, and stressing how she couldn't be sure it was the same man, at trial, she was much more confident as a witness, insisting that the man she had seen at the church that night had looked like the man in the photograph of Dennis Perry, and acknowledging only obliquely that she couldn't be certain of her identification. Still, even if Cora Fisher had been unwavering and certain in her identification, even if Dale Bundy is right that Cora Fisher could never have been moved from her statement that the photo of Dennis Perry was the same man that killed the Swains, the same can't be said for Vanzola Williams. Vanzola always had doubts about her identification of that photo of Dennis Perry, even if by the time of trial, she only expressed her doubts in a guarded way. It seems more than possible that her identification could have been affected by a suggestive lineup process. But what if there was some way we could go back in time and show Vanzola Williams a true lineup right from the start? If we could go back before Jane Beaver had shown her the single photo of Dennis Perry and asked if he was the killer, and instead had shown her a real photo array, one that had Dennis Perry's picture along with five other photos, and asked her if any one of the photos looked familiar. If we could unring that bell, if we could somehow impossibly put that genie back in the bottle and erase the suggestive single photo identifications from Vanzola Williams' memory and ask her to identify the killer once again, well, would she have been able to pick Dennis Perry out? Well, according to Special Agent Joe Gregory and Deputy Butch Kennedy, we don't need a time machine to answer that question. Because, according to them, Vanzola Williams was shown exactly such a lineup in 1988. After getting a tip from Corky Rozier, Kennedy and Gregory had investigated Dennis Perry and sought a photo from him from every jurisdiction that he had contact with. We know that's true because Kennedy's remaining notes from the case file document his careful attempts to track down just a picture. But while the documents in the case file do not show that Gregory and Kennedy ever succeeded in their hunt, well, today both of them remember that they were successful. Agent Joe Gregory had finally tracked down a photo of Dennis Perry that was taken close in time to the murders, his driver's license picture from the DMV that was taken in December of 1985. And Gregory and Kennedy had taken that photo and put it in a lineup alongside five other photographs and shown all of them to Vanzola Williams. And they asked her if there was anyone in the photo array who looked like the killer in the vestibule at Rising Daughter that she had spoken to. And Vanzola Williams told them that there was not.
When Perry, that was another thing we did. When Perry's name came up, I contacted the Driver's License Bureau and they sent me a driver's license photo that was within, I think, 12 or 13 months of the date taken, within 12 or 13 months of the date of the crime. Put it in with five other photographs, and Vanzola looked at that. She could not pick out anybody. Nobody even was close, according to her.
Thank you.
And that's all for episode 3 of Undisclosed, The State versus Dennis Perry. As you may have noticed, despite the fact I told you all at the end of last week's episode there'd be no addendum last week, there was in fact an addendum last week. However, this week there really is no addendum. So we'll be back on Monday with episode 4. Methil Telhan is our executive producer. Our logo was designed by Baluki. And our theme music is by Ramiro Marquez and Patrick Cortez. Audio production is done by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media. You can find out more about Dennis's case at the Georgia Innocence Project's website at georgiainnocenceproject.org. Huge thanks to GIP intern Ed Kostikian for his assistance on this case. Transcripts of this episode and previous episodes will be available on our website at undisclosed-podcast.com, prepared by our transcribing team, Britta Bliss, Erica Fladell, Don Logos, and Skylar Park. And of course, thank you to all of our sponsors for making it possible for us to come back week after week. Don't forget to follow us online. On social media, our handle is at UndisclosedPod. That's Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if any of our listeners out there have information on Dennis Perry's case that you'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com. That's all for this week, and thanks so much for listening.